Well, I'd like to welcome Dr. Dan Nightingale to the Caregiver Smile Summit. He is CEO of Dementia Therapy Specialist in the U.S. and Dementia Doctor in the U.K. He's also an actor, a stand-up comedian who was trained by Dr. Patch Adams. He's the world's leading clinical dementia specialist, world-renowned for his pioneering empirical published research in the use of hypnotherapy as a treatment option to alleviate many of the symptoms associated with neurocognitive disorders. Welcome, Dr. Nightingale, to the summit.
Thank you. I'm very, very pleased to be here.
Well, I am also an entertainer and musician, so we're both health professionals, so we have a few things in common before we even get started here. So we're here to talk a little bit about dementia and to help people understand a little bit more about it, because obviously the headlines always scream Alzheimer's, but as professionals, we know there's different types of dementia out there. So with so much inaccurate information out there, can you please explain what the term dementia is?
Yeah, the term dementia is just a descriptive word for a set of symptoms. That's the easiest way to describe that. So, for example, if you go to see your doctor and he says you've got a chest infection, then what you need to do is find out, why do I have this chest infection? What is causing this chest infection? And, you know, the word dementia is very, very similar. There's a whole host of causes that lead to dementia-type symptoms. And some of these are primary causes and some of these are secondary causes. When we talk about primary dementia, we're specifically talking about things like Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, you know, the types of dementias that we recognize as being dementia. There's also secondary types of dementia, like having an overactive thyroid gland, for example, that presents with similar symptoms to Alzheimer's disease. And we can easily treat that with a course of medication, and within a space of 3 to 4 days, the person is going to return back to normal function again. So I think, you know, personally and professionally, the word dementia is something that needs to be phased out. We need to be saying goodbye to that actual word, because, you know, it's a negative term. It means demons in the brain. That's the Latin definition of dementia. So it's a negative term to start with. And in the new DSM-5, which is the statistical manual for diagnosing all kinds of disorders and diseases, we've got rid of that word dementia. So we don't diagnose people with dementia anymore. We diagnose people with a neurocognitive disorder. And it can be a neurocognitive disorder of the Alzheimer's type, or a neurocognitive disorder with vascular dementia, so with vascular disease. So we're kind of phasing out that word dementia from a clinical point of view. And one of the main reasons for that is the stigma that's attached to dementia. And the second reason is the confusion that's attached to dementia. Because I'm sure, like you, Anthony, you know, one of the first questions people tend to ask me is, so what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? So you get into that, having to define those things. And of course, if anybody has that question, then the answer is Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia. So, you know, to summarize that point, the word dementia itself is a descriptive word meaning a set of symptoms.
Gotcha. So is that language, you know, diagnosing people with a neurocognitive disorder, really become pervasive across the world?
It's going to take time to come in. And, you know, from a clinical point of view, we do it. But we still use the word outside of the clinical area, dementia, because that's the word that everybody's familiar with. So I think we need to go down this educational program of, you know, phasing out dementia and phasing in other terms. Something that I see used quite often, actually, a more positive and a more gentle term, is cognitive change. I like that. You know, I like to use that. That's a good term, cognitive change, and because it describes a lot of the things that happen in a lot of the different types of dementia. So I think we're going to see it phased out eventually, but within the mainstream community and the mainstream field of cognitive change, we are still using the word dementia.
I like that cognitive change, because obviously we're always changing, and it is a more positive connotation. And language means a lot in this arena. So you mentioned some of the different forms of dementia. Alzheimer's and vascular. I also know Lewy body disease. What other ones are there? And kind of combining a couple questions that we were talking about previously, or what are the common signs to look for with each of those?
Okay, there's also a type of dementia which is kind of coming as being the fourth most common type of dementia, called Pick's disease, PICK'S, Pick's disease, and that's a kind of frontal temporal lobe dementia that causes the person to lose all inhibition, and it's a very, very challenging type of neurocognitive disorder. So Pick's disease is another one. We're seeing a lot of relative to traumatic brain injury from footballers and soccer players with head injuries. So we're looking at something called pugilistica, which is basically punch drunk syndrome. It's the one that boxers often get. If they have a type of dementia, it's usually punch drunk syndrome or pugilistica, which is quite possible that Muhammad Ali had. He had Parkinson's disease, we all know that, but it's quite possible that he may have had a type of dementia with the pugilistica as well. So that's another one, and there are many types. There's over 100 different types of neurocognitive disorder, and some of them are very, very rare that we're not likely to see very often, if at all. There's a disease called CADASIL, a type of neurocognitive disorder whose acronym is CADASIL, and I've only ever seen two cases of that in my 20 years of clinical practice, so that's quite an unusual one. So there are many, many different types and forms. Sure. But I think the ones to be, to focus on are the most common types, which is Alzheimer's disease, which is probably affects around about 60 to 70% of all cases is probable Alzheimer's disease. And then the second type, as we mentioned, something called vascular dementia, which maybe 20% of other people living with dementia. But what I want to say here is that it's very common to have mixed. So what we're discovering today is that Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia seem to be very, very closely linked. There's a link between the two. And it's very, very common to have both as what we call a mixed type of neurocognitive disorders. So there are many, many ones to look out for. But if we focus on the most common one, which everybody talks about, probable Alzheimer's disease, then, there are three things that point towards a possible cognitive change and indicates that further investigation and tests are required. And the first thing, of course, is people are familiar with the fact that people have a challenge with their memory, and it tends to be immediate memory, working memory, or short-term memory. And that seems to be the first thing that we see. But that on its own is not indicative of Alzheimer's disease or any other type of neurocognitive disorder. It needs to be accompanied by other things, because we all forget stuff. We all the typical one is you go upstairs to find something, you get upstairs, what have I come up for? And you go back downstairs, and when you get to the bottom of the stairs, I remember, and I'm back upstairs again. These are typical things. We've got so much stuff. Our brain filters so much information at any given time. In this room at the moment, I've got light, I've got artificial light, I've got natural light. I'm thinking things. There's thoughts running through my mind. My brain is picking up all kinds of sounds and images, and it's filtering them out. So it's understandable that sometimes we become forgetful. That's not an issue. It's not a problem on its own. It's when we see a couple of other things like disorientation in time and place. So if you were to ask somebody who was going through a cognitive change, what time do you think it is today without looking at your watch or looking at a clock? What time of day do you think it is? And they're likely to struggle with recognizing that it's just after one in the afternoon. and they may say it's 10 in the morning or 12 o'clock at night. So that's another thing to be looking out for. And the fact that they may have lived in a familiar environment for a long, long time, but they're struggling to find their way around. So maybe struggling to find the bathroom from the bedroom. So those things are indicative as well. And the third thing that I would be looking for is struggling to follow a sequence of events, struggling to follow a recipe, struggling to follow something that is a normal thing for people to do on a day-to-day basis. An example of that would be my mum makes the best apple pie in the world, and everybody knows about it, and she's very popular, and people will go to her house on a Sunday just to get a piece of apple pie. And one day, they take a piece of this apple pie and take a bite, and it's got salt in it. And so she's put salt in there rather than sugar. Now, this could just be an accident, but very unlikely. And if it happens again, and there's other things, you know, struggling to follow simple sequences and events, then those three things would point to, you know what, I think there's a bit of an issue here. I think there's something that we need to investigate further. And you would probably see that in most common types of neurocognitive disorder, those similar kind of things. If we're looking at Lewy body type dementia, that's different. It's one on its own, is that? Because something happens with Lewy body type dementia that doesn't happen in any other type of neurocognitive disorder. And that is change in ability from hour to hour or from day to day. So one day I might be able to get up, function, do my job, and then the next day I might not even be able to string a sentence together. So that's something that is indicative of Lewy body type, neurocognitive disorder. And a couple of other things with that as well is falling without any explanation for that, difficulty with visual or spatial awareness, so maybe not being able to see a white cup on a white background, that kind of thing. So those are the things I'd be looking for in terms of early signs of a neurocognitive disorder.
Okay. So here's a question. If some people are starting to see these signs, you know, we know that there's not enough, I guess, geriatricians to go around for what the need's going to be, and that primary care physicians are probably going to have to step up somehow. But I know, for example, one of my friends has Lewy body from the Dementia Action Alliance, a colleague of mine, and, you know, they struggled for a year or more, some year and a half before they were properly diagnosed. What do you suggest to our viewers in terms of if you're starting to see some of these signs, what do they do next?
Okay, note them down. First thing is keep a kind of diary. So note down all these changes that you're seeing. What are they? When are they occurring? You know, what time of day? What is it that's changing in that person? What is it that they're having a problem with? What are they struggling with? And so make a list of all these changes and try and keep a diary for, say, a week about all these things that are happening and all these things that are changing. And then your first point of contact is your primary care physician. Go and see your primary care physician. Go and see your GP and talk to them about these issues that you're seeing. One of the challenges, Anthony, is encouraging the person that's having these challenges to actually go to the doctor and to recognize that there is an issue. That's one of the challenges we have, because very often people will say, oh, I'm all right, there's nothing wrong, I'm fine, I'm okay, I don't need to go and see the doctor, I'm okay. So it's that gentle encouragement that we need to say, you know what, let's just go and get it checked out. Because it might be something really straightforward. It might just be that you're getting an infection. And we know that a UTI, urinary tract infection, can lead to these kind of symptoms. So maybe we should just go and see the doc and get it checked out. So a gentle encouragement to get the person to go and recognize that, yeah, there is a little bit something wrong is the first challenge. But once we get them there and we've got a diary and some notes about the changes, some evidence that we can show the physician and say, you know what, I've got some concerns here. So maybe you could do a cognitive function test, a mini mental state questionnaire, or a SLUMS examination, or, you know, whichever one the primary care physician uses, because there are different tools, but they're quick and they can give you an indication of whether or not there is something going on cognitively in terms of a cognitive change. And then it would be about, you know, referring on to a neurologist or referring on to a memory care clinic where they can do all the psychometric tests and the brain scans and all the other assessments. So that's what I'd be doing. I'd be noting down these changes and making sure I see a consistency in them.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Good information. So does dementia primarily affect older people? Because, you know, I've been seeing, and it's a virtue of my work, partly with the Dementia Action Alliance, we have a lot of early onset folks. But, you know, also we have a society that's more aware of it. As you mentioned, some of the testing that happens earlier, we used to maybe call it something else. Is this the disease just for older people, or what are you seeing?
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. This is another one of the kind of misunderstandings and misconceptions about neurocognitive disorders. It can affect younger people. It can affect, I've had a patient as young as 24. I've had a child as young as 12. So, you know, they're very unusual, those cases, but they do happen. So if you look at the UK, you have around about 850,000 people living with a diagnosis of a neurocognitive disorder. 42,000 of those are at working age. So by working age, I mean under the age of 65. And very many of them are still at work. And of course, that brings so many different challenges to them. They have so many responsibilities, usually more responsibilities than seniors. You know, if seniors have retired and they've paid off their mortgage, maybe the kids have grown up, they've already gone through college. If you're younger and you develop a young onset neurocognitive disorder, then we're looking at different challenges. You know, you may have a massive financial burden for a start, and it changes in terms of family dynamics and stuff like that. So there are different problems and different challenges for the younger guys. So 42,000 there, I think there's about 16,000 in Canada that have young onset dementia, and around about 64,000 in the US that have young onset dementia too. So, you know, there's a whole group of younger people who are seeing this, and it increases as well year on year, Anthony. Those statistics increase year on year, which gives rise to concern. But I think when we address your next question, I think we can talk about that and talk about why that's happening and how we can avoid that.
Sure.
The risk of that. But yeah, and you know, there's a type of dementia called Niemann-Pick's type C that people might not be too familiar with. And certainly generalists in the profession aren't very familiar with it. And that affects one in 150,000 children. They're born with dementia. Oh. And they usually present with symptoms around the age of 10. And that's kind of Alzheimer's type symptoms. And they progress pretty quickly. And it's not a good outcome. It's a negative outcome for those kids. So we are, you know, we do see children, and we see animals as well. You know, dogs. Dogs are very, very prone to developing a canine type of dementia. So, you know, it affects a lot of people and a lot of species, and it's not age discriminate at all.
That's interesting. So obviously somebody's going to be listening or viewing this, and they might get a little scared actually. So, and you did mention, you know, people are born with this. So is there any preventative action that people can take to reduce their risk? And then what does the genes play in all this?
Okay. In terms of heredity, you're usually looking at like 1% of the total population of people with a neurocognitive disorder that is a hereditary type. And a big bulk of that is Huntington's. Huntington's disease is a genetic form of neurocognitive disorder. So it doesn't play a massive role. There is some evidence that if your sister not too sure about brother, but sister, if your sister has a neurocognitive disorder, for example, specifically Alzheimer's disease, then there's an increased risk that you will, you know, develop Alzheimer's disease. But there's nothing definitive. And this is the challenge with this type of neurocognitive disorder, you know, that there is nothing definitive. We're learning more and more about it. There's more and more research, but we don't really know a massive lot about causality is the thing that has to be nailed before we can move on to treatments and things like that. So, but I wouldn't get, you know, for viewers, I wouldn't get too concerned about the heredity stuff and about the genetics. I wouldn't get too concerned about that at all. That's not a big issue. There are other things that we can do for prevention and reduce risks than thinking about heredity and genetics.
Okay. So that said, you know, are there anything people can do to, you know, help in this? I mean, we've, you know, a lot of times it comes down to some basics, you know, exercise, and you've heard a lot about playing mind games and keeping your mind engaged. Is there any definitive evidence out there of things we can do that actually will maybe delay onset or delay progression or maybe even prevent? Who knows?
There is, Anthony. There's a few things. So let's talk about diet and nutrition first, because diet and nutrition is, it seems as though diet and nutrition is playing a major part in a contributing factor to the increase of dementia, especially in the younger generation. So young onset dementia is possibly linked to diet and lifestyle. And look at it, we live a fast-paced life. There is stress everywhere. Fast food is everywhere. It's convenient foods. We live a very busy lifestyle. We've got so many things to do, so many responsibilities. It is so easy to get home at night, sit down in front of the TV with a microwave meal. It's difficult with kids as well when you're bringing kids up, and it's difficult to make sure that they're enjoying a nutritional meal and that they're enjoying a healthy diet and lifestyle, because, you know, the draw from McDonald's and Burger King and KFC and Taco Bell and all those other places, it's just, they're so well marketed that people just go there all the time. You know, they're always busy places. So I think we have to take a step back and have a look at our diet and nutrition. And we all know, we hear about the five pieces of fruit and vegetables a day, which is healthy for us. But I think we need to think about home-cooked food. You know, cooking food at home is so important. You know what your ingredients are. You know what you're putting in there. There's so many chemicals being used in foodstuffs today that we can't always guarantee that that's healthy stuff that we're buying from supermarkets. So we've got to be really, really careful about what we're buying and what we're cooking and how we're cooking it and what we're eating. So diet and nutrition. The recommendation is that we live off a Mediterranean diet, which is obviously high in fruit and vegetables and salads and greens and olives and those kind of things. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that turmeric is a really good spice for the brain. So that's another good thing to, you know, you can sprinkle turmeric on anything. You know, you can take turmeric capsules, but the best thing is, you know, if you have a boiled egg in the morning, tick a little bit of turmeric on top of it. It's good, straight to the brain, good stuff. So spices, you know, Indian spices and things like that are very good as well. There's a book being published by a neurologist in Phoenix called Dr. Marwan Sabha. People may be familiar with that name, Marwan Sabha. And he wrote a book called, just let me look on here because he's written it with another guy. It's the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook, and he wrote it with a chef called Bo Macmillan. So Dr. Marwan Sabha and Bo Macmillan have written this book, which is absolutely fantastic. It's got some brilliant recipes in there, and it uses a lot of fish, and it uses a lot of spices and stuff like that. So I would recommend all the viewers to have a look at that, to have a look at the book. You'd be able to get it on Amazon or somewhere like that. and it's called, again, the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook. And Marwan Sabha is spelled M-A-R-W-A-N S-A-B-B-A-G-H. And that is a book that I highly recommend. One of the things that people can eat is blueberries, one of the superfoods, fantastic for the brain. So eat blueberries. Just, you know, eat blueberries. It's a really good super brain, super food for the brain. One of the things that has been gaining a lot of momentum and a lot of attention is coconut oil. Dr. Mary Newport in Florida is a physician, and her husband, Stephen, I think he's called Stephen, he developed Alzheimer's disease, and he was prescribed Aricept, which is usually the first thing that you think about, and it was not good for him at all. It made things worse. So Mary, she took him off Aricept, she discontinued it, and she read somewhere about the benefits of coconut oil. So she gave him coconut oil, and she saw a massive change in his symptoms. They reversed his symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Stephen was her accountant, practice manager, and he went back to work. Yeah, so he began functioning again.
Wow.
And so from that, Mary tried to get people to do, you know, the pharmaceutical companies to do some research into the benefits of coconut oil. And of course, no, there's no money in that for pharmaceutical companies. So she got South Florida University to do a research project. And I haven't seen the results of that yet. I haven't seen a paper published on the outcomes. But I believe they were using a research project that involved 46 people living with a neurocognitive disorder versus 46 people who weren't, and maybe getting a placebo. Not too sure how they were running the trial, but that's been happening. And of course, there's something out there called Axon. Some people may be familiar with Axon, A-X-O-N, which is a kind of powder that you put on your food. And what the company that produced Axon did was took, it's basically a powdered version of coconut oil. Coconut oil works through medium chain triglycerides, which is a substance that penetrates the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. Probably the only thing that does penetrate the blood-brain barrier. But when you take coconut oil, it goes straight to the brain, and it has this this benefit on the brain. So every patient that I work with who has a neurocognitive disorder, I always recommend that they take coconut oil on a daily basis and that they cook with coconut oil. Some dentists recommended as well, actually, and they recommend swilling coconut oil around your mouth first for a few minutes and then swallow it. It's helped with healing cavities and gum disease and all kinds of stuff. So that's the diet and nutrition side of things. I think education plays a massive role as well. And it doesn't mean a formal education. You don't have to go and study degree after degree after degree. But just keeping your brain working. Keep learning different things. Learn something new every day. Do something different every day. If you're right-handed, try using your left hand for a little while. Wakes the brain up a bit. Because, you know, the brain is the laziest organ in the body. If you were allow it to, it would do nothing. It would sleep 24 hours a day because it is lazy. So, you know, make it work. Keep it awake, keep it alert, and keep it on its toes by doing different things. Fasten your buttons with your left hand if you're right-handed. Do all those different things that
make... Brush your teeth with your other hand, yep.
Exactly, absolutely.
Take a different route to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the age of 40 onwards, our hippocampus, which is a part of the brain responsible for memory and some other stuff, it shrinks by around about 0.5% every year. That's a lot when you think about it. And that can lead to us having some difficulty with our memory. So what can we do about that? Well, some research out of China that has demonstrated, or is it Japan? Japan or China? Not to, I'm just thinking off my head here. That comes out of Japan or China that's demonstrated that walking 20 minutes a day and using those adult colouring books and staying within the lines, so really focusing and concentrating on colouring in the picture in the adult colouring book, has arrested that shrinkage in the brain. But it's also started to help it grow again. So that's a really, really interesting piece of evidence and research that shows that, you know, there are things we can do. There are things that we can do to change how our brain changes through age, as we start to age. We're people who are in this field are very familiar with neuroplasticity and how that works and how the brain can regenerate and how you can use various techniques and strategies to lay down new neuronal pathways in the brain. So which basically means that if you lose a skill, then you might be able to relearn it again through some repetitive muscular activities and things like that. Excuse me. So there are many things we can do to reduce our risks of developing a neurocognitive disorder.
Okay. Thank you. That's a lot of great information. I was taking notes. And the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook, I'll just say that again, because I think they're going to get some business after this. So from a clinical standpoint, what treatment options are available?
Well, unfortunately, as we know, there is no cure for the primary neurocognitive disorders. There's no cure for Alzheimer's disease. There's no cure for vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia. Although, you know, there are things we can do to live well with those types of neurocognitive disorders. So people who have got it, it really is now about living well with it, enjoying life, doing things. Continue to do as much as you can. Continue to enjoy life, basically. Just enjoy it. One of the things that I advocate against so strongly, more or less every single day in the media and on social media, are these negative terms, suffering from, a victim of, you know, and we're not, you know, people don't become victims of, and they don't suffer from, unless you tell them they are suffering from. Because if you give people that label, that's what they're going to do. They're going to, you know, they're going to suffer. They're going to be a victim. So really it's about living with as well as you possibly can. In terms of treatment, some things that can help are things like hypnotherapy. You know, that I can talk about that because that's my research. So hypnotherapy, helping relieve some of the symptoms. Dementia is fueled by two things, and that is fear and anxiety. Imagine waking up every single day in a new world. It's a different house. It's a different face. Everything's different. Everything's new. You've got to get used to it again and again and again. Very, very scary. So nothing remains consistent. So your fear and anxiety fuel the symptoms, and they exacerbate the speed in which the disease progresses. If you use hypnotherapy, and we've even seen now that if you use basic relaxation techniques and basic yoga, you manage the fear and the anxiety. The fear and the anxiety dissipates. And if you take somebody into a deep state of hypnosis, a deep state of relaxation, it frees up all the cognitive thoughts that are negative. You know, you're wondering, what's that person's name? I can't remember that person's name. I can't remember. What are they called? Who's that? She says it's my wife. Is that my wife? I don't recognize her. Who is she? And you're building up with your anxiety and you're building up with your fear. And there's going to be an event at the end of it, a negative event. So take somebody into that deep state of relaxation and make some positive suggestions and just take them to some special place, you know, the place you like to be more than anywhere in the world. I lived in Drumnadrochit, which is in the Scottish Highlands, and Loch Ness runs through Drumnadrochit. And my special place, there's a rock that just goes out into the lock. And I like to sit on that rock. That's my special place. So for me, I would just close my eyes and just drift off to being there and seeing all the beauty and feeling all the positive energy and feeling all the positive love that's around me. And really, all my fear and anxiety is just going down and down and down. And I'm beginning to take control again. So things like that are really, really helpful. I think there's a lot of research going on. There's a lot of research in medication in the pharmaceutical companies. Nothing yet has succeeded. As I said at the beginning, we have to really find the root cause before we can find a cure. Right. I think if we're looking at diet and lifestyle, we all have a responsibility to change that. We can change it. We can change our lifestyle. We can change our diet. And that's, you know, there's a book called The Nun Study. You might be familiar with, Anthony. Aging with Grace, The Nun Study by David Snowden. And again, viewers, that is the book I would highly recommend if you're looking at how to reduce your risks of developing Alzheimer's disease. He did a fantastic research study, and it's still going on, The Nun Study. It's still ongoing. David's now retired, but somebody else has taken it over. And have a look at that. You can get that from Amazon for about $3. It's really cheap, that book.
Right.
And it's got some really good stuff in there about lycopene, you know, taking lycopene. Lycopene you find in cooked tomatoes. Lycopene you find in grapefruit. Lycopene you find in watermelon. That's good stuff. That's good for you. So, you know, just simple changes in diet and nutrition is a thing to be doing.
Absolutely. So, you know, given all we've covered, and we've covered quite a bit, and I thank you for that. Will there be a day when we're not going to talk about this anymore because there's a cure? What's the hope out there?
I think that's a very, very good question. And I think our challenge is that we are all living much, much longer. And as we age, we become more prone to all kinds of things going on, you know, from cancer through to cognitive change. You know, we become more at risk the longer that we live, the older we become. However, I still believe that we can reduce those risks and age well. We can age well. We can exercise. We can eat a healthy diet. We can, you know, try and manage our stress levels and make those things go away. If you look at the rate of cardiovascular disease in the world, it's horrendous. And a massive, massive factor of vascular dementia is cardiovascular disease. And how do we get that? Apart from, you know, the hereditary side of it and the genetic side of it, not much we can do. But the bulk of it is due to diet and lifestyle, and we can change that. We talk about, in America, we talk about obesity, we talk about diabetes, massive, massive challenges for the healthcare system. And of course, you know, with dementia, certainly with Alzheimer's disease, having diabetes unmanaged and uncontrolled is a high risk factor of developing Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, there are those things. It really comes down to our lifestyle, Anthony, and I think we can age well. There's a lot of dementia specialists and neurologists and psychiatrists who specialize in dementia that wouldn't agree with that we're not supposed to live this long. We're supposed to reproduce and then we're supposed to die off, because that's, I guess, what we're supposed to do. But we've gone through this process of evolution, and we're a developing society, we're a developing species. And I'm seeing, and I'm sure you are, and I'm sure your viewers are seeing it as well, more or less every day I see something like a 101-year-old marathon runner, a guy that was 100 I saw yesterday, he did a skydive. He skydived out of a plane at the age of 100. And there's a woman out there who does weight training, and I think she's in her 80s, and she's as fit as a fiddle. And so I think when you look at those people and you look at their lifestyle, that's that's what's going to help us, changing our lifestyle. And it's never too late to change. It's never too late to lose a bit of weight. It's never too late to get into the gym. Never too late to, you know, cook a few home-cooked meals, cooked with love kind of thing. So I think that's the main thing. And I think we're just going to live longer. This isn't going to change. I think we've slowed down a bit. I was reading some research a few days ago that says that we have slowed down in terms of life expectancy. And there's a bit of concern in the geriatric medicine field as to why is that happening? Why is it slowed down? What's happened? And I think, you know, you can speculate by saying, well, look at diet, look at lifestyle, and maybe that's one of the answers for that. Sure. So there's a lot of hope, but I think we have to, as a society and as an individual, we have a responsibility to take responsibility for our own health and well-being. You know, we can't blame other people for it, and we can't tell other people, you know, it's your fault that I'm sick. We have a responsibility to look after our brain health, our physical health, and live a really good, healthy lifestyle. And I think if everybody adopted that philosophy, which is very, very difficult, but I think if everybody adopted that philosophy, Anthony, we would see a reduction in the rates of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. I don't think in over the last few years in the UK, I think we've seen a bit of a decrease in the rate of diagnosis. So maybe that's a pointer. You know, maybe there's something happening there.
Maybe people are finally heeding the message.
I think. But, you know, one of the other things that I like to advocate as well is getting into schools and talking to children. Because if we're talking about preventative health, preventative disease, we need to talk to kids. We need to talk to children about how this works and how you can look after your brain and your physical body. I have some friends who are Mennonites. I'm very close to the Mennonite community, which is a kind of religious type of people, a really nice group of people whose philosophy is to help community and help society. That's what drives them. But they asked me last year in Arizona if I would go and speak to their children in their Mennonite school, because they don't do brain anatomy, they don't do physiology and anatomy and biology as a curriculum in the Mennonite community. So I went in and spoke to the kids about brain health, and they loved it. They were really, really accepting of it, and they asked some fantastic questions. And so they went away with a bit of information and a bit of education about, yeah, you know, I'm 14, 15, and I can really take responsibility for my health and avoid or at least reduce my risk of getting those types of neurocognitive disorders. So I think children, we need to start with children and get into schools and talk to them about how we can change our lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Well, Dr. Dan, I want to thank you personally. It was great meeting you virtually, and thank you for being part of the Caregiver Smile Summit.
Thank you very much for asking me. It's been a pleasure.